Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Tam Kennedy.
Today we're diving into the federal news update for Wednesday, September 25th, 2025.
Yeah.
And wow, there's a lot happening. The source material from just the last, 48 hours, it paints a picture of Washington under some serious pressure.
That's putting it mildly. Our mission today is really to give you that granular, detailed look at everything significant that's unfolded since the start of September 24th. Because what we're seeing, it's this unique confluence of institutional stress.
Okay, break that down. What are the key forces clashing here?
You've got three main things happening at once. First, an executive branch that's being incredibly assertive, really pushing its agenda. Second, a legislature that's, well, basically paralyzed, gridlocked.
Yeah, that much is clear.
And third, maybe most importantly in the long run, a judiciary that seems actively poised to fundamentally redefine the whole balance of power in government. It's quite a moment.
That tension definitely comes through. So given the urgency, we really have to start with the biggest, highest stakes standoff, right?
Hmm.
The government shutdown deadline, September 30th, is looming.
Absolutely. That's the immediate crisis. And the language, the actions around the shutdown threat this time, they've gone way beyond the usual fiscal brinkmanship we see.
How so? What's different?
Well, it feels like it's being weaponized, like a political tactic specifically designed to achieve policy goals, maybe even policy destruction. The really key action came from the White House Office of Management and Budget, the OMB. They sent out this directive to agencies.
An unprecedented directive, the sources say. Unprecedented how? Because normally a shutdown means, you know, temporary furloughs, people miss paychecks, but eventually they get back pay, right?
Exactly. That's the historical playbook. But this new OMB memo, it instructed agencies to draft plans for permanent job elimination.
Permanent, not furloughs.
Permanent job eliminations. That's the crucial radical shift. And these aren't based on like safety needs or who's an essential worker. No. The memo specifically targets programs the administration deems not consistent with the president's priorities.
Whoa. Okay, that's a different level entirely.
Yeah.
Isn't that politically incredibly risky? Laying off permanent federal workers? How do they think that plays out?
Well, the calculus seems to be, according to the analysis we're seeing, that they're using this temporary fiscal crunch, the fact Congress hasn't passed funding bills, to push through long-term conservative policy objectives.
Like shrinking the government.
Exactly. Permanently shrinking the federal workforce, eliminating programs they've long opposed, but doing it without having to pass legislation through Congress, which is obviously stalled. The bet seems to be that this energizes their base, which prioritizes cutting government, even if it alienates some moderates.
So it turns a temporary funding fight into a tool for permanent ideological restructuring. And the political backdrop kind of confirms this hardball approach, right?
Yeah.
Congress was basically MIA on the 24th.
Yeah, totally inert. They were in a designated district work period, technically. But the reality is paralysis. Just look at the appropriations bills, the 12 annual bills needed to fund everything. Zero have been enacted. None.
And the public messaging reflects that impasse.
Oh, absolutely. The White House and Republicans are pointing fingers squarely at the Democrats. The rhetoric is about a $1.5 trillion wish list, accusing Democrats of radical left insanity for, quote, holding funding hostage.
But the Democrats aren't budging either, are they?
Yeah.
They're blocking the straightforward continuing resolution, the clean CR, that would just keep things funded temporarily. What are their non-negotiables?
It's all about health care for them. Specifically, defending and building on the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. They won't pass a CR unless Republicans agree to two major things, which are, first, extending those enhanced ACA subsidies, the ones that help millions pay their insurance premiums. They're set to expire soon. That's crucial for them.
Okay. And second?
Second, they want to reverse some specific Medicaid cuts that were passed in earlier Republican legislation. So for Democrats, this isn't just about funding levels. It's a fundamental fight over the social safety net. Healthcare is their red line.
And then, just to pour gasoline on the fire, the president canceled that planned meeting with minority leaders Schumer and Jeffries. That doesn't exactly signal an urge to compromise, does it?
Not at all. It signals the opposite. A real hardening of the positions. It makes a prolonged, damaging shutdown seem much, much more likely.
And the cost. We often talk about the political cost, but the economic cost is real too.
Hugely real, and likely underestimated this time. The National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, NRFE, they've put out a serious warning. They're saying the cost of this potential shutdown will be significantly higher than the last big one in 2018-2019.
Which already cost billions, right? Something like $11 billion?
That was the estimate, yeah. $11 billion hit to the economy.
So why would it be even worse this time? Is it just about length, or is there something else?
It's that threat of permanent job loss. That OMB memo creates massive uncertainty. Think about it if you're, say, a skilled engineer at the Department of Transportation or a scientist working on climate models at DOE.
Yeah.
Even if your specific job is deemed essential for now, if your whole program is on the chopping block because it's not consistent with the president's priorities, what do?
Start looking for another job, somewhere more stable.
Exactly. You get a potential brain drain. Losing people with decades of institutional knowledge on incredibly complex issues, nuclear safety, infectious disease protocols, managing critical infrastructure, that kind of expertise isn't easily replaced. It permanently weakens the government's ability to function, and the cost of rebuilding that capacity is way higher than just covering back pay after a furlough.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a deeper, more structural risk. So while Congress is gridlocked over funding, the executive branch isn't just sitting still. They're actively pushing policy through other means.
Right? Yeah.
Using executive power where legislation fails.
That's the other major theme of the last 48 hours, policy by executive fiat. We saw really significant moves at the Department of Energy and the Department of Education.
Let's start with energy. What did Secretary Chris Wright announce?
A massive clawback. Secretary Wright declared the department's intention to return over $13 billion in unobligated funds back to the U.S. Treasury.
$13 billion. Where's that money coming from?
It's money originally allocated by the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, funds that hadn't been spent yet. And the secretary was very explicit. This fulfills a promise to stop, quote, reckless spending on climate policies.
So a direct reversal of the previous administration's signature climate legislation funding. What specific kinds of programs are losing this $13 billion?
It hits a lot of the core infrastructure and decarbonization efforts funded by the IRA. We're talking about unobligated balances for things like siting new transmission lines.
Which is crucial for getting renewable energy onto the grid.
Absolutely critical. Also hits various DOE loan programs that finance new clean technologies, grants for energy efficiency contractors, and big projects aimed at decarbonizing heavy industry. Pulling funding for transmission siting alone could seriously slow down grid modernization.
What was the justification given, beyond just reckless spending?
The rhetoric was pretty stark. Secretary Wright argued that global climate initiatives have basically failed to lower emissions while simultaneously driving up energy costs for Americans. He actually called the previous climate agenda a wasteful green new scam.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So the message to the energy sector, to investors, is crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
The federal spigot for these big decarbonization incentives, it's being turned off abruptly.
That's a major policy shift executed purely through administrative action. And at the same time, over the Department of Education, we saw them moving on two fronts.
Yeah, a coordinated two-pronged strategy from ED, both actions announced on September 25th, really advancing their specific vision for education in the U.S.
What was the first part?
A huge financial commitment to charter schools. ED announced a record $500 million in grant funding for the charter schools program. That's the largest single investment in that program's history.
$500 million. And the stated goal?
Explicitly to expand school choice and support innovative educational models. It's a massive boost for a decentralized, market-based approach to K-12 education. A clear signal of priorities.
So a big push on the K-12 side towards choice and charters. What was the second prong? That involved federal student aid, right?
Exactly. This was more administrative, but really important for millions of students and families. ED announced the earliest ever launch date for the 2026-27 free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA form.
Ah, the FAFSA. People will remember the nightmare rollout a couple of years ago.
Precisely. They're framing this early launch as directly correcting that infamously botched rollout. Remember all the delays, the processing errors? It caused chaos for students waiting on aid packages.
So what's actually different this time? What did they fix?
They focused on fixing the process bottlenecks. The announcement highlighted a redesigned system for contributors, parents, spouses to submit their financial info more easily. And critically, instant account verification.
Okay. That sounds like it would speed things up.
Yeah, it should eliminate a lot of the delays from manual reviews or data mismatches. And apparently, the beta testing went really well. They're citing 97% user satisfaction. So launching it early, closer to the traditional October 1st goal set by Congress, looks like an administrative win for them, fixing a prior mess.
So if you put those two ED actions together, promoting school choice with big grants and making sure the federal aid system for college runs smoothly, it looks like a very deliberate strategy.
It absolutely does. Using two different levers, grant funding for K-12 policy, administrative efficiency for higher ed to push a comprehensive education agenda forward, all without needing new laws from Congress.
Okay, let's shift gears now. From these domestic policy fights and fiscal cliffs to something much darker, the tragic shooting at the ICE facility in Dallas on the morning of the 25th.
Yeah, just a horrible event. It happened early, around 6:40 a.m. at the Dallas ICE field office on North Stemmons Freeway.
What do we know about the shooter and the incident itself?
The gunman was identified as Joshua John, 29 years old. Sources note he studied at Collin College for several years, from 2013 to 2018. He apparently opened fire from an adjacent building using a bolt-action rifle.
And the casualties. This wasn't random, was it?
Tragically, no. The victims were people in ICE custody. One detainee was killed, and two other detainees were critically injured. No ICE officers were physically harmed in the shooting itself. The shooter, John, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound at the scene.
And the evidence points towards a specific motive.
Yes. The FBI is investigating it as an act of targeted violence. And crucially, law enforcement found anti-ICE messages actually written on the bullet casings recovered at the scene. That makes the ideological motivation pretty clear.
Just awful. What was the immediate federal response from Homeland Security?
DHS put out a statement saying they would immediately increase security at ICE facilities all across the country, which makes sense.
And there were concerns raised about the security of these facilities even before this.
Yeah, former acting ICE director John Torres spoke about this. He pointed out vulnerabilities at places like the Dallas office, things like bus loading areas being really exposed, nearby buildings offering clear vantage points for a sniper, and those long lines of people waiting outside for check-ins, often unprotected. He basically said these facilities weren't designed for the kind of threat environment we face now.
And almost inevitably, this tragedy got sucked straight into the political vortex. The blame game started immediately.
Instantly. You saw a stark partisan divide. On one side, Vice President J.D. Vance and Senator Ted Cruz came out strongly, calling for an end to rhetoric that, in their words, demonizes ICE and demonizes CBP. They argued that this kind of language leads directly to violence.
And President Trump weighed in.
He did, on Truth Social, blaming deranged radical leftists for the attack.
And the response from Democrats.
Equally swift, but pointing the finger in the opposite direction. The Texas Congressional Democratic delegation released a statement blaming the Trump administration itself for, quote, stoking the flames of division, hate, and anger. They argue the administration's own rhetoric and policies create the climate for such extremism. So the shooting immediately became Exhibit A in the fight over political speech and its consequences.
And the sources mentioned this isn't happening in a vacuum, especially in Texas. There's been a pattern recently.
That's a really important piece of context. This is the third significant incident targeting ICE or CBP facilities or personnel in Texas just since July.
Third? What were the others?
There was that attack outside the Prairie Land Detention Center on July 4th. An officer was injured. 11 people were ultimately charged. And then just a few days later, July 7th, there was a shooting outside the Border Patrol facility down in McAllen. An officer was injured there, too, and the shooter was killed. So, yeah, the sense of threat against these agencies is definitely escalating.
Okay, so we have the human cost, the political fallout, and then there's the money. This increased threat level, combined with existing border security priorities, is apparently fueling a massive spending surge at DHS.
Oh, absolutely. The federal contracting world is buzzing. They're positioning themselves for billions, literally billions in new funding coming from that legislation dubbed the One Big Beautiful Bill. And a huge chunk of that is earmarked for CBP and ICE.
How much are we talking about?
The numbers are pretty staggering. We're tracking $6.2 billion allocated just for CBP, mostly for border security tech and advanced screening systems, and another $700 million specifically for IT upgrades at ICE.
So this is driving a boom in security technology. What kind of tech?
I think high-tech surveillance detection and countermeasures. One area DHS specifically flagged as a priority, even back in August, is counter-drone technology. There was talk of a contract worth over $100 million just for that.
Because of the potential threat from drones.
Exactly. Used for surveillance by smugglers, or potentially even for attacks. So you're seeing this gold rush, not just for the usual big defense contractors, but also companies specializing in AI for threat analysis, big data aggregation, sophisticated screening systems. The tragedy, unfortunately, immediately accelerates demand for these multi-billion dollar solutions.
Right. Let's pivot now to the third branch, the judiciary. You mentioned earlier they seem poised for a major shakeup. Where is that pressure coming from?
The biggest tremor is coming directly from the Supreme Court. On September 22nd, they made a really significant move. They granted a stay in a case called Trump v. Slaughter.
Okay, Trump v. Slaughter. What's significant about the stay?
Well, first, it was 6-3 along ideological lines. But more importantly, granting the stay effectively fast-tracks the case. It signals the court is eager to rule on the core issue, and it sets up a potentially monumental challenge to the independence of federal agencies.
What's the core issue? What precedent is being challenged?
The case directly questions whether the rules protecting commissioners of independent agencies from being fired by the president without good cause specifically, the protections for FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter in this instance, violate the Constitution's separation of powers.
And those protections go way back, don't they?
90 years back. They're challenging the landmark 1935 decision, Humphrey's Executor v. United States. That case basically established that agencies designed to be expert and non-political, like the FTC, need insulation from direct presidential control to function properly and apply policy consistently without political interference.
So the fact the 6-3 majority is fast-tracking this case suggests they might be ready to overturn Humphrey's Executor and embrace this idea of the unitary executive.
That's exactly the fear and the likely trajectory. The unitary executive theory argues the president must have complete control over the entire executive branch, no exceptions for independent agencies.
And if that theory wins, what does it actually mean? What power would the president gain?
It would be transformative. It could mean the president could fire at will for any reason or no reason, purely political reasons, the commissioners or board members of any so-called independent agency.
Like the FTC dealing with monopolies.
Right. Or the FCC regulating communications and media.
Or even the Federal Reserve.
That's the biggest one. The Federal Reserve, which sets interest rates and manages the economy. If the president can fire the Fed chair just because they don't like their monetary policy or want lower rates before an election,
the markets would freak out. Global markets.
It would likely cause chaos. The Fed's credibility hinges on its independence from short-term political pressure. If that's gone, confidence in the U.S. dollar, in treasury bonds, in long-term business investment, it could all be severely damaged. Justice Kagan wrote a really sharp dissent when the stay was granted. She warned the majority was basically using the emergency docket, the fast track, to hand full control of all those agencies to the president.
That really does sound like a potential constitutional earthquake.
It absolutely could be, and it's moving quickly.
Okay, so that's the huge structural challenge. But the judiciary was also intervening on a more immediate level, policing the executive branch's language.
Yes, a different kind of judicial action, but also significant. Down at the district court level, Judge Margaret Garnett issued a directive on September 24th. It was about public statements being made by White House and DOJ officials regarding Luigi Mangione.
The person accused in that high-profile murder case.
Right. The judge specifically called out characterizations like the White House press secretary calling Mangione a left-wing assassin. Judge Garnett stated that kind of language likely broke court rules designed to prevent prejudicing a potential jury pool and ensure a fair trial.
And she didn't just issue a general warning, did she?
No, she was very direct. She instructed the prosecutors in the case to specifically advise Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, that's a very senior DOJ official, that future violations of these rules by officials could lead to sanctions.
Sanctions against the deputy AG.
Potentially. The judge put them on notice. It shows a federal judge actively trying to rein in political commentary around a criminal case to protect the judicial process itself.
And one more judicial item, a ruling related to those inspector general firings.
Right. On September 25th, a federal judge ruled that President Trump did violate the Inspectors General Act, the IGA, specifically by not giving Congress the required 30 days notice before firing 17 agency IGs back when that happened.
Okay, so a finding that the law was broken. That sounds like a win for government oversight, for the IGs.
Well, yes and no. The judge found the law was violated, but she also ruled she couldn't actually reinstate the fired IGs. Her reasoning was that even though the initial firing procedure was flawed, the president could legally just refire them after giving the proper 30-day notice. So the fired IGs couldn't demonstrate the kind of irreparable harm legally needed to force their reinstatement.
Ah. So a legal violation was found, but there was no practical remedy for the people who were fired.
Exactly. A bit of a hollow victory for the IGs themselves, though it does set a precedent about the notice requirement.
This whole theme of government functions being impaired, it seems to extend right down to the basic ability of federal employees to get their workplace disputes resolved. Tell us about that ruling from Judge William Alsup back on September 12th.
Yeah, Judge Alsup's ruling was a real warning flare. He basically suggested that federal courts might need to start taking over federal employment disputes directly. Why? Because the administrative agencies that are supposed to handle these things are, in his words, functionally impaired. They just aren't working.
Functionally impaired. That sounds bad. Which agencies are we talking about?
He highlighted a trio of key agencies responsible for the federal employment system and described how each is essentially broken right now.
Okay, let's take them one by one. Which is the first?
First is the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB. This is like the main court for federal employees appealing things like wrongful firing, discrimination, whistleblower retaliation.
And what's wrong with the MSPB?
It can't issue final decisions. Why? It doesn't have a quorum. It's been operating with only one board member since April. You need more than one to make binding rulings. So thousands of federal employee appeals are just stuck in limbo indefinitely. Their legal rights are effectively denied because the board can't function.
Okay. No quorum at MSPB. What's the second agency Judge Alsup mentioned?
That's the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the FLRA.
Yeah.
This is the body that handles disputes between federal agencies and the unions representing their employees.
Is it a quorum issue there, too?
Technically, no. The FLRA has two members currently, which is a quorum. But as Judge Alsup rather bluntly put it, when the two members are constantly disagreeing, often along ideological lines, having two votes is no better than one or none.
So gridlock means nothing gets done.
Pretty much. Their output has plummeted. He cited an example. In July 2025, the FLRA managed to decide only one case. Compare that to six cases decided in July 2024. The whole system for resolving labor management disputes is just grinding to a halt.
Wow. Okay, MSPB has no quorum. FLRA has gridlock. What's the third agency in this failing trio?
The Office of Special Counsel, or OSC. This agency is supposed to be the watchdog protecting whistleblowers and ensuring hiring and firing are based on merit, not politics.
And what's the problem there? It's not quorum or gridlock, is it?
No, it's something arguably even more concerning. Judge Alsup noted that after a recent leadership change, the OSC dramatically reversed its legal position on a major issue.
Reversed how?
The previous special counsel had actively fought against a government plan, an OPM order, to potentially fire up to 25,000 federal employees who were still in their probationary period. The new leadership at OSC, they completely repudiated that stance and are now actively supporting the plan for mass firings.
So the agency meant to protect employees,
in Judge Alsup's stark words, started working for the other side. When the agency designed to protect whistleblowers and merit principles flips its mission like that, it has a chilling effect across the entire federal workforce. Who do you trust?
Yeah, that's deeply troubling. This functional impairment has real consequences for individual federal workers. Let's shift now to a threat facing the public's ability to oversee the government. The Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, what's happening there?
There's a developing situation that transparency advocates are calling an outright attack on FOIA. The group American Oversight has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Energy.
What's the lawsuit about?
It's challenging a notice the DOE published recently in the Federal Register. This notice puts a new burden on people who have pending FOIA requests submitted before October 2024. They now have just 30 days to proactively contact DOE and reconfirm that they are still interested in their request.
And if they don't reconfirm within 30 days?
DOE says it might just close their request, administratively close it out.
That sounds like a way to clear a backlog very quickly, but potentially lose a lot of important information requests in the process.
That's exactly the concern. American Oversight argues it's an unlawful policy change that flips FOIA on its head. FOIA has a presumption of disclosure. The burden is on the agency to process the request or state a valid exemption. This new rule shifts the burden entirely onto the requester to keep their request alive.
And it seems particularly tricky for people who didn't submit requests via email.
Yes, that's a major flaw. The notice says DOE will try to email people, but if the original request was sent by mail or fax and didn't include an email address, which could be true for many older requests, or requests from less tech-savvy individuals or groups, those people might never even know their request is about to be closed unless they happen to constantly monitor the Federal Register.
That seems designed to make requests disappear. And losing access to this information isn't just theoretical, right? There's a real-world example cited of why old records matter.
A powerful example. The lawsuit highlights how, just in 2023, FOIA requests uncovered DOE records, going all the way back to 1949. And these weren't just dusty files. They proved the agency knew for decades about radioactive waste contamination near Coldwater Creek in St. Louis.
Contamination linked to cancers in the community.
Directly linked to a cluster of rare cancers. Information the government had arguably downplayed or hidden for years. If a policy like this new DOE rule had been in place back then, allowing them to close out those old, pending requests, that crucial evidence might never have come to light. Justice for that community could have been denied.
That really drives home the stakes. And this isn't just happening at DOE, is it? This idea of making requesters reconfirm seems to be spreading.
Unfortunately, yes. The Independent Foreign Aid Agency, USAT, has published a similar notice. They're looking to administratively close requests that were sent before January 20th, 2025, if they don't hear back from the requester.
So the fear is this becomes standard practice across the government.
That's the worry among transparency groups. If these first moves by DOE and USA aren't challenged successfully in court, they fear this policy shifting the burden onto the public to keep requests active could spread like wildfire through the entire federal bureaucracy, making government oversight much harder.
Okay, one last quick item on the federal workforce before we move on. There's an update on how employees are being vetted for security clearances.
Yeah, just a technical but important update on modernization. The IRS and the Veterans Benefits Administration, the VBA, are expanding their use of a system called Trusted Workforce 2.0.
Trusted Workforce 2.0, what is that?
It's run by the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, DCSA. It provides continuous vetting for federal employees, even those in non-sensitive public trust positions. Instead of doing those big periodic reinvestigations every few years, this system uses automated checks of various databases, criminal records, financial activity, foreign travel, things like that on an ongoing basis.
Well, constant monitoring instead of periodic deep dives.
Essentially, yes. The idea is it's both more secure, catching potential issues faster, and potentially more efficient, speeding up the whole vetting and onboarding process.
Got it. Okay, let's broaden our scope now. The last 48 hours also saw some really significant moves and statements on foreign policy, military matters, and public health. Where should we start?
Maybe with the sudden shift we saw regarding Ukraine and Russia.
Right, President Trump's social media post. That seemed like a real change in tone.
It really did. After a period of sounding more neutral or even skeptical about continued aid, he posted quite forcefully on September 24th. He affirmed Ukraine's ability to, quote, fight and win all of Ukraine back. And he dismissed Russia's military advances, comparing them to a paper tiger.
That's a significant rhetorical shift. Was there any official explanation for why the sudden change?
The explanation offered via UN Ambassador Mike Waltz was that it reflected the president's personal frustration and disappointment, specifically with Vladimir Putin. Frustration that Russia hasn't achieved a quick victory and hasn't been able to stabilize the situation. So maybe less a calculated policy shift, more an expression of presidential pique.
And how did Russia respond?
Predictably. The Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, basically shrugged it off, saying Russia has no alternative but to continue waging war. Signaling they aren't changing course based on rhetoric from Washington.
Okay, sticking with international issues but involving technology and security, that TikTok deal finally seems to be coming to a head.
Yes. After years of back and forth, the White House confirmed that President Trump is expected to sign the executive order finalizing the security deal later this week.
And the deal involves Oracle overseeing things.
That's the core of it. Oracle gets the massive, unprecedented task of overseeing the security of all U.S. user data. That data has to be stored domestically on Oracle servers.
But it's not just about where the data is stored, is it? The algorithm is the secret sauce.
Exactly. That's the really tricky part. The deal mandates that Oracle must also oversee the retraining of the TikTok recommendation algorithm specifically for U.S. users.
Retraining it how? To do what?
The goal is to ensure it's free from any potential Chinese government influence or surveillance capabilities. How you technically achieve and verify that is a huge challenge, but it's central to the deal. It sets a major precedent for how the U.S. might regulate other foreign-owned tech platforms with national security implications.
Interesting. Okay, shifting to the U.S. military itself, a major announcement regarding the Fort Hood shooter case.
Yes, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced he is formally seeking the death penalty for Major Nadal Hassan, who carried out the 2009 mass shooting at Fort Hood.
Seeking the death penalty?
Yeah.
Has he requested final approval?
He has. The final decision rests with President Trump, but Secretary Hegseth stated he is 100% committed to seeing it carried out. If it proceeds, it would be the first execution conducted by the U.S. military since 1961. A really significant moment in military justice.
Wow, that is historic. Yeah. And also on the military front, the Air Force is changing how it tests fitness.
They are. They announced a new initiative called Culture of Fitness on September 25th. The biggest change is adding a mandatory 2-mile run to the standard fitness assessment.
A 2-mile run for everyone?
For everyone. And the other change is frequency. The test will now be required twice a year biannually for all airmen and guardians, regardless of how well they scored on the previous test. It used to be less frequent for high scorers.
So tougher standards, tested more often. When does that kick in?
It takes effect March 1st, 2026, so a clear move towards emphasizing higher, more consistent physical readiness across the force.
Okay, and finally, let's touch on public health. There were two notable items, one quite controversial, the other a serious warning. Let's start with the controversy.
Right. This involved President Trump making public comments on September 25th promoting claims widely considered unfounded by the medical community linking the use of Tylenol, the common pain reliever acetaminophen or paracetamol, during pregnancy to an increased risk of autism in children.
Unfounded claims. How did the medical establishment react?
Swiftly and strongly. Major health organizations like the World Health Organization, WHO, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, immediately pushed back, condemning the remarks.
What were their main message?
They stressed that the actual known risks of not treating fever and pain during pregnancy are far greater and much better documented than any speculative or unproven link between Tylenol and autism. Untreated high fever, for example, can be dangerous for both mother and fetus.
So it created confusion and potentially undermined trust in medical advice.
Exactly. It's another example of that tension between political figures and established public health guidance. It got to the point where Vice President Vance had to issue a kind of cleanup statement, basically just advising pregnant women to follow your doctor.
Okay. And the second public health item was a warning from the CDC.
Yes, and a very serious one. The CDC issued an alert about a dramatic surge in a specific type of antibiotic-resistant bacteria called NDMCRE.
NDMCRE. Why is that particular one such a concern?
Because it's resistant to most, sometimes nearly all, available antibiotics. The CDC describes it as extremely hard to treat and often deadly. And the numbers are alarming. They reported a 460% increase in cases between 2019 and 2023.
A 460% increase. That's staggering. What's driving the surge?
The CDC pointed to gaps in infection control practices within healthcare facilities, combined with limited capacity for testing and surveillance across the country. It highlights a really critical growing vulnerability in our healthcare system facing these superbugs.
Okay, so if we try to pull all these threads together, everything we've discussed in the last 48 hours. What's the big picture narrative that emerges?
I think the dominant narrative is one of concentrated executive power operating in an environment where other institutions are either paralyzed or potentially being reshaped to align with that power.
Yeah, that seems right. Start with Congress, basically gridlocked and unable to perform its core function of funding the government.
Right. Which then creates the opening, the crisis that the executive branch leverages, like with that OMB shutdown memo, to try and achieve permanent ideological policy goals that couldn't get through legislatively.
And simultaneously using executive orders and administrative actions like at DOE and education to bypass Congress entirely on other fronts.
Exactly. And then you have the judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court with that Trump v. Slaughter case, seemingly poised to potentially grant the presidency even more power by dismantling the independence of regulatory agencies. It's like the checks and balances are being systematically weakened or bypassed.
So for you listening to this, the key takeaway is that in this current environment, major policy isn't necessarily happening through laws passed by Congress anymore.
Right. It's happening in these administrative memos, in emergency court rulings, through executive orders, in the fine print of regulatory notices. That's why understanding these granular details, the stuff we dive into here, is actually more critical than ever to grasp how Washington is really working or not working.
Absolutely. And maybe the final thought to leave people with, building on that judicial piece,
yeah,
really consider the long-term systemic instability that Trump v. Slaughter represent. Just noodle on this.
Yeah.
If the unitary executive theory prevails, if the president can fire the head of the Federal Reserve at will or the chair of the FCC or the FTC purely for political reasons, what does that actually do?
What's the impact on global markets' confidence in the U.S.? How does it affect long-term business planning if regulations can swing wildly based on who's in the Oval Office day to day?
And maybe most fundamentally, how does it redefine what we even mean by the rule of law when it comes to economic and regulatory policy in the United States? That decision being fast-tracked right now isn't just a legal case. It could genuinely be the constitutional earthquake of the decade, something we all really need to watch.